Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, Hannah Storm.
And me, John Crowley. In these podcasts, we'll be talking to journalists, many of them household names, about the stories they've covered and the experiences that have impacted them, how they try to make sense of it all, and how our industry is adapting to the realisation that we need to protect our storytellers. Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and longtime journalists.
Journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in. But as we're frequently told, never become the story, which, as we'll hear, can often be hard.
For this episode, we've been speaking with Clive Myrie, a journalist, newsreader and presenter for the BBC. He recently returned from Ukraine, where he slept in a makeshift bomb shelter in an underground car park. He was hailed a hero by some for his reports from there. We began by asking him what he made of this notion of a journalist being a hero.
From my perspective, I mean, it's nonsense, really. Speaking very personally, I mean, the public, you know, they can have their own ideas about who we are and what we do. That's their prerogative. But, you know, we're not trying to be heroes. We're just doing our job. And that job can take me from, you know, presenting Mastermind and interviewing different people in all walks of life. And it can take me to a war zone. I mean, it's just part of my job, and I've been doing it for 30 years. And if people feel that there are things that come out of the reporting that they can latch on to, that they find interesting, that they find important, then that's fine. But all we can do is our job.
Just on that note about the just doing your job, you talked about this idea that journalists have a choice and make a choice to carry on reporting, to make a choice being in a place which is dangerous. So how important is that sense of choice in helping you manage your mental health?
Yeah, it's critical. It's very, very important. And the BBC as an employer is actually very good at that. I mean, you know, there is no suggestion that if you don't go to Ukraine, it's going to be detrimental to your career. There's no suggestion that if you don't go to a war zone, then, you know, you're not doing what you should be doing. It is a free choice, absolutely. And I certainly felt that. And there are lots of people who were asked to go and who didn't go. And I also think it's vital that you're not compelled to work in a hostile environment, because if you're not feeling comfortable in yourself in that kind of stressful situation, then that's when you start potentially making mistakes. If you don't feel confident about the environment in which you're working and in which you're living, whether it's sleeping in a makeshift bomb shelter in a car park two floors down beneath the ground, or having to broadcast as you know, there are potentially missiles heading towards your location. If you're not confident in those situations because you've been compelled to be there, then that's when you start making mistakes. And it's critical, frankly, that in any stressful situation, we all make the right decisions. And that is more so in a war zone. So you've got to be comfortable about being there under your own free will. No question about that.
It's a privilege, right? We have this privilege, and it's a privilege that's not afforded to those with whom we come into contact on the ground, those whose stories we're amplifying, I suppose.
Yeah, we've got a way out. We can leave the war zone. You know, the people that we're talking to a lot of the time, they can't escape, potentially. You know, it's their lives that are being uprooted. It's their jobs that are disappearing. It's their communities. It's their families, that family life that's being disrupted. And they're living the conflict potentially for the rest of their lives. We're living it to a much lesser degree over a limited period of time. And I think we have to be mindful of that, particularly when people are willing to give us their time as interviewees in a war zone to tell us about their lives, to share their stories. You know, we have to be mindful that they're sharing with us something very precious, and that is, you know, their experience of the particular conflict in question. And it's an important thing that we're dealing with. We're dealing with, you know, their history and their narrative. And we've got to be mindful of that, and mindful of the fact that they are all consumed by it in a way that we potentially are not.
In our first episode, Clive, we spoke with your mate Lise Doucette and Lindsay Hilsum about this notion of risk How do you balance that desire to keep on reporting and managing risk?
No story is worth dying for. I have a family, I have friends, I have people who love me. For me to put myself in the situation where I'm not calculating the risk properly, I'm staying longer than perhaps my instincts are telling me I should be staying longer in a war zone. I am playing with my own life and death. That's unfair on the people who love me and my own narrative as a human being, frankly. So I'm not willing to take a risk that I do not feel is justified and one that has not been calculated to the nth degree for any story. And I'm pretty sure that Lindsay and Lise and Jeremy Bowen and all of them are the same. But I began this interview with the notion that this is what we do and it's our job. So we are likely to take the kind of risks, because it is our job and because we love our jobs, that others perhaps are not willing to take. But that does not mean that we're willing to die if we can help it. So, you know, I mean, Lise is still there, Lindsay is still there. There were things that my cameraman needed to do, things that I needed to do, which was why we left commitments which were very, very important. World Book Day. Davey McElveen, my cameraman, has two kids. He'd been there for a month. He needed to get home. And that is important. And I was willing to stay for another 10 days or so, possibly 2 weeks, on top of the 10 days that had already been there. But we all act as units. And I was not going to begrudge him that. Absolutely not. And consequently, we're both now going to go back refreshed, re-energized to carry on this work. So, you know, we'll all have individual reasons as to why we will decide that this is the moment to break off, this is the moment to stay, and so on and so forth. But as long as you're making those calculations regularly, and you are thinking about your own mental health, you're thinking about your family at home, the kind of stress that you're putting them through, you know, you're thinking about the commitments that you've made, all that kind of stuff. As long as you're doing that regularly and you're not just drifting day after day, week after week, and you end up being there for 6 months and you end up getting tired and you're not realizing you're getting tired and you end up making sloppy decisions that could end up endangering not just you, but the team you're working with. As long as you're making those calculations all the time, regularly, risk assessing, that's the key. Now, that could mean that some people leave after 3 or 4 days. It could mean that some people leave after 3 or 4 weeks. But it's all up to the individual, and that's the critical thing.
I'm really struck by this idea of the unit, and particularly what you mentioned about David and, you know, wanting to get home to the family and his kids in World Book Day. And I mean, I've got my own kids, and gosh, World Book Day is incredibly important to them. So I think there's this idea of, you know, balancing the work you do as a journalist with the fact that you also have a life at home and you also have to manage that as well, don't you?
Yeah, and it's about understanding that you've got commitments to a whole range of people in a whole range of areas. And it was, yeah, I mean, I hope he won't mind me saying this, but it was when we were broadcasting live from the bunker, the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news, and there were lots of kids just running around, you know, just being kids, you know, not really having any proper comprehension of the moment that they're living through. Of course, their parents do. They were just running around, and it was seeing the kids running around that made Davey realize, you know what, I need to get back. I've been here a while, I need to get back. And it's little moments like that that can make you realize that you've got commitments in other areas as well, and that temper your enthusiasm potentially, because, you know, you're a correspondent, you're a reporter, you're a journalist, and this is potentially one of the biggest and far-reaching stories, arguably, since the end of the Second World War, certainly since the end of the Cold War. There's a part of you that says you want to be part of that, but at the same time, you've got commitments as well. And it's in losing sight of those other commitments and losing sight of who you are, where I think you can get into trouble and where I think you can end up losing perspective and perhaps detrimentally affecting your own mental health in a way that perhaps, you know, you're not really thinking about your friends and your family and your marriage and your relationships and all that other stuff because you're so all-consumed. You've got to keep a sense of perspective. And actually, frankly, keeping that sense of perspective means that you end up telling the story better, because I think it means you can see things more clearly and you do not get sucked into the narrative of one side, for instance, as opposed to another. That kind of thing. It just helps, I think, clear away the cobwebs and allow a measure of the right kind of objectivity.
Thank you. That perspective is such an important thing, I think, as well. But of course, you know, again, it's slightly back to the choice. You know, we are recording this podcast now at the end of March. As we speak, at least half a dozen of our colleagues have been killed, many of them local journalists. It's our local colleagues, isn't it, who take the biggest risks.
It is. And as I said earlier, you know, they're living the story every single day. They are people who know the communities that are being devastated. Sometimes they've lost friends and family, or they actively have to take part in the hostilities. I mean, my driver, Georgi, he told us that he couldn't continue working with us because he got called up. You know, he had to join the reservists. So the story touches local workers, local fixers and drivers and producers and so on in a much deeper way. And we've got to be cognizant of that and give them, you know, every single kind of help and backup that we can, because it is a much more personal commitment that they're making.
They're so instrumental to us being able to tell the story well, right? Yeah. To us being able to stay safe as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my Ukrainian's not as good as it used to be, and it's marginally worse than my Russian. So if I don't have someone who speaks the local language, I'm shafted, you know. And of course, I know that there are areas that I may want to go down in terms of covering the story. And it may be that those local people and those local fixers and whatever, the drivers who know the alleyways to avoid the checkpoints and so on and so forth, it may be that they're thinking, well, I'm not so sure about going down there. I think that might be a bit dangerous, or, you know, so on and so forth. So you listen to, you absorb that local knowledge, you imbibe that local expertise, and you take it on board. And you see yourself as an equal partner to those people. Because without them, because they can end up saving your life, just as I could end up, you know, having to help keep them safe in a particular situation. We all have to work for each other in a war zone. And we've all got to have confidence in each other. And that means understanding, you know, where they're coming from in terms of the wider narrative of this story.
Clive, you're a trustee of the Rory Peck Trust. Tell us a little bit about the work that they do and the particular threats that freelance journalists face.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great organisation that I've been aware of for many years as a correspondent and presenter. And I was very pleased and honoured that they asked me to become a trustee a couple of years ago. Turning up to the board meetings has been a bit tricky, I have to say, and I missed the last one. Because I was in Ukraine, but they've forgiven me for that. And it's brilliant. It's essentially an organisation that looks after the welfare of freelance journalists. You know, those people who are out there covering stories right around the world in difficult circumstances without the backup of a major organisation like the BBC or Channel 4 or CNN or whatever. And they're doing it off their own bat. They've cobbled the money together. They've flown in. They've got their equipment, and they're going to try and cover the story as best they can as freelancers. And one of the biggest problems, for instance, in this conflict is freelancers who don't have protective equipment, you know, don't have flak jackets and they don't have helmets. And that's the kind of area where the Rory Peck Trust can help. And so, for instance, they've got an appeal at the moment, which is linked to their partners in the Journalists in Distress Network. And they're trying to raise money so that they can get flak jackets, first aid kits, basic stuff like that, as well as helmets and other protective gear to journalists who are freelancers in this kind of reporting. And interestingly, I mean, two or three of the people who have sadly died, you know, they were freelancers. They did have protective kit, I think. But, you know, You don't have the backup of a big organization. You don't necessarily know whether someone's going to be able to medevac you out because, you know, you've been injured. To have something like the Rory Peck Trust behind you that you can call upon is a really good thing. So I'm very proud to be part of that organization.
I want to take you back a moment to Ukraine, if that's okay. You shed some tears at one point, which caused quite a lot of attention. Looking back on that moment, what's your thoughts on that now?
Yeah. It was an emotion, had been an emotional day, no question about that. And I mean, I'd flown into Kyiv something like 15, 16 hours, actually probably less than that, 12 hours before the invasion began. So I saw for a slither of time what the city was like before hostilities began. The capital was bustling. It's quite a young population in the centre of the city. Great restaurants, people all out. The sun was shining, actually. It was a beautiful day. And then this war starts. And all that had brought to mind the conflicts that the Russian military had fought before in Chechnya, in Syria. And having sort of briefly spoken to a few people on the street about what a coming war might have involved and them saying that they were going to fight, and given my own knowledge of the way the Russian military embarks on conflicts, that just suggested to me that this was going to be a bloodbath and it was going to be a horrible, horrible war if there was not any kind of capitulation on the part of the Ukrainians, because the Russians have the manpower. At that stage, 190,000 troops had been ringed around, certainly to the north, the east and the south of the country. They have the latest missile batteries and so on and so forth. So it just struck me that this was going to be a horrible conflict, especially after the leveling of Grozny in 1999 and the devastation, widespread devastation of parts of Syria by the Russian military. So it had been for me, and then contrasting all that to what I'd seen the day before, a lively, bustling city and a confident young country. So it had been an emotional day. And I was standing on the rooftop of the hotel where we were broadcasting, and it was frankly windy. It was windy. And the wind blew across my face and across through my eyes, and the single tear came out. So I'm not saying that I was crying for Ukraine, because the wind was blowing. What I will say is that it was an emotional day, and that's it.
It was an emotional day, and it's been an emotional few years, hasn't it, really? I mean, before Ukraine, you spent much of the past couple of years covering the impact of COVID on communities and on the National Health Service. In January this year, there was a really powerful piece that you did when you went back to the Royal London. And I'd like to quote a line from that piece back to you and get your thoughts on this. You said, "We all looked within, appraising our own capacity to cope." Hearing what you've just said there about the single tear and the wind and the emotional day, how have you coped during these unprecedented times?
On a very, very basic level, it's been manageable because I kept working, you know, and while the weight of the argument was on lockdowns in order to protect the population, I mean, I fully understood why some people were upset about that, because their livelihoods disappeared. I mean, just like that. So on a very basic level, still being able to pay, you know, the mortgage and feed yourself, I managed. I was coping because I was working every single day. And it's important to reflect that, actually, just on a very basic human level, how hard it was for a section of the population to buy into the whole lockdown narrative. But at the same time, I saw what it was like in those critical care units. And it was hell on earth. It absolutely was hell on earth. The first two waves of the pandemic in March, April, May of 2020, and then December, January, February of 2021, they were as bad as anything I've seen in any war zone anywhere on earth. And I felt it was important to reflect that. And I also felt it was important and honest, frankly, because in a similar situation, I would have covered every single angle of the story. I mean, I was filming in morgues in Mexico covering gang violence and a massive upsurge in gang violence, 2018, 2019, you think was. And we filmed in the morgues, you know, bodies on the floor, rotting. The fridges were overloaded. I mean, it was horrible. We filmed in there. No one batted an eyelid, right? I remember covering the war in Kosovo in the late 90s. And I filmed in and near a morgue there as well, again, because the fridges weren't working. It was just awful. If you can't deal with the dead and you can't give the dead dignity, then you've completely lost. And it's partly why I've gravitated towards morgues, I suppose, in times of conflict. And I did the same in the Navajo Nation in Arizona during COVID. In the summer of 2020, I was talking to a mortician dealing with the huge rise in deaths among Native Americans. Interestingly, they were willing as a population to wear masks, and it was the white population of Americans around them who weren't, and they were bringing COVID into their communities. So I did the same at the Royal London Hospital. And I thought, hang on a second, we've got, at that stage, it was maybe, I think it was getting towards 100,000 dead, right? The civilian deaths in the Second World War were around 70,000 in the UK. So we're talking about a problem that has killed more people than the civilian dead of the Second World War. And we were not talking to the morgue people, the morticians. We were not talking to the grave diggers. We were not talking to the people who have to deal with the end result of this. And I found that really shocking because it felt to me as if we were somehow subconsciously censoring the gravity of this story. And so I decided that was what I was going to do. And I would say 95% of the response was, oh my God, you've managed to bring home what this story actually means. Because the vast majority of people were not touched health-wise by COVID. But it was such a large, tiny section of the population that was touched, as I say. So it was. I felt it was important to bring that story home. But 5%, oh my God, how could you film in a morgue? How dare you do that? I mean, I'm eating my dinner at 6 o'clock at night. How could you do that? And for me, what was brilliant was that all those pieces went right to the top of the BBC. And when I say the top, I mean the top, okay? To decide whether or not that stuff should go on air. And not a single person said, cut it. And I felt that was testament to us trying to get across the severity of this story in as rounded a way as possible. And I am so proud that that myself and Davey and cameraman, the guys with me in Ukraine, and Sam Pirenti and all the editorial people involved in that. I'm so glad we did that because it brought home the reality of what was going on. And if you've got all the facts and you've got the reality, you can then make an informed decision. And you can actually say, well, you know what? I'm not going to wear my mask on the tube, even though everyone's telling me I should, and the government's telling me I should, and Chris Whitty's telling me I should. I don't care anymore. I'm not going to wear my mask. But you know what? At least you'll be doing that, having all the facts in front of you and having a clear idea of what the hell is going on with this story. And that is all we try to do as journalists, whatever the story is. And it's why Lise is still out there. And it's why I'm going back. And it's why Lindsay's still out there. And, you know, you're just trying to tell the truth of the story. And actually also, in the age that we live in, try to knock down some of the crap that appears from propagandists online, people who just want to cause mischief. And you hope that people will believe you and that the narrative and the truth, as far as you can tell it, from an honest broker, I hope people will feel that I am, or Lise's, or Matt Fry is, or whatever. You hope that it sinks in somehow and counters, you know, the BS, and there's so much of it that is out there.
That reality was so powerful, that the dignity that you brought to the people, and you really were showing the reality of the story. But the reality of the story is, isn't it, that certain people have suffered more in the past few years. And you know, the past couple of years have highlighted the significant emotional burden carried by many Black and minority ethnic people and Black and minority journalists, the acute racial injustice that came to the forefront of the media after the murder of George Floyd, and the disproportionate impact the pandemic's had on people of colour. How has racism and racial inequity affected your career?
I would say very, very little. Very little. And I know that I'm lucky in that regard. And I know when I say this, you know, there are some members of the Black community who are like, really? Really? And I'm like, well, yeah, frankly. You know, I've in the BBC, I've achieved everything that I wanted. You know, I became a foreign correspondent. I lived abroad for many, many years, reporting on some great stories, and had, you know, I've had a wonderful life on the road. And I'm still doing that to a degree, even as a presenter. And these are things that I think some people in the Black community might feel, well, you know, you're glossing over the racism, and I'm sure there must have been. And yeah, I mean, they're a bit isolated examples, but you know, the vast majority of my working life has been a happy one from that perspective. Absolutely no question about it. And I've always seen myself, and always tried to get this across to the BBC, as a reporter who happens to be Black and not a Black journalist. I am not a Black journalist. I'm a journalist who just happens to have a bit more melanin in his skin than a few other folk. That's it. It really, 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 when you think about it, is not a big deal. But getting that across can be tricky. It might feel like it's a simple process and an easy thing for me, but it's a tricky thing. But the BBC understood it straight away. They did. And I made that clear at the beginning of my career in London. And funnily enough, talking to Sir Trevor MacDonald, he did exactly the same thing at ITN. He had to tell them, I'm just a journalist who happens to be Black and not the other way around. He did the same thing, and they understood him too. So you need an employer who's willing to understand that. And if they understand it from the get-go, then that hopefully means that in the intervening 10, 15, 20 odd years, you, fingers crossed, will not have many problems. And as a result, you know, my first posting as a foreign correspondent was to Japan. I mean, yes, there's an African-American link in that, you know, there were Black GIs there during Reconstruction after the war and so on and so forth. And they love their jazz and baseball. But there are not a lot of many Black people in Japan. But the BBC understood what I was trying to get at. And I hope the public, when they see me now, they see Clive Myrie, who happens to be a journalist. And the fact that I'm Black is the last thing they think about. But there are stories that pop up where you think, well, what is Clive Myrie thinking? He is a Black guy. What is he thinking? And, you know, it's not that I feel a responsibility to sort of address that, but I sort of feel it might be a bit odd if I didn't on isolated occasions. So early on in the Ukraine crisis, I'm live on air, 1 o'clock news, and I'm on a Black broadcaster's WhatsApp group. Anyone who's Black in the industry is on it. And I'm seeing all this stuff. They're not letting Black people cross the border. This is racist. They're not letting Black people cross the border. So I'm live on the 1 o'clock news. Mark Lowen is there on the Polish side of the border. And I say to him, Mark, there are suggestions Black people are not being allowed across. What's going on? I just did it as part of the story. Didn't make a big deal of it. Just did it as part of the story. I'm in Atlanta covering the election of Barack Obama. He wins. I'm on air with David Dimbleby on the special program. And I say, look, you know, for someone like me at this moment in time, this place, it is a privilege to be here on this day. No one batted an eyelid. In fact, a couple of people said it was absolutely the right thing to do. And it might have been a bit odd if I didn't say something along those lines. But I genuinely felt that at the time. So, you know, it's about perspective. It's about making that link between the public's reaction to a story, if it is about race and so on, and the fact that I am a person of colour. It's choosing your moment, but it's somehow not making a big deal of it, if at all possible, but acknowledging the fact that, yes, covering the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, as I did, I am obviously going to be potentially responding in a different way to if Lisa was doing it or if Jeremy Bowen was doing it. But at the same time, I can totally understand that there may be a different way that Lisa might approach covering a vigil for Sarah Everard than perhaps I would. And I think we need, in this modern age, and it is an age of feeling, I think it's an age of emotion, it's an age where sort of individual truths are important and vital. I think it would be odd if a journalist didn't somehow, in a way that was not overshadowing the story, reflecting their own sense of self within the story. There are so many variables. It depends, but you've got to be careful. But having said all of that, race has not been something that has been a particularly important part of my working life. It just hasn't.
Thanks for speaking so expansively there. Can I take you on to your? You were talking there about passions. On your Twitter feed, you describe yourself as a foreign correspondent, a Man City fan, and a lover of opera. And you can argue the way that Man City play football right now, and it's an opera intersect many ways in terms of art. You also spoke there about jazz as well, and you recently hosted a program, on Radio 3 about that, didn't you?
And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's for me, it's been about the last few years, I suppose the last third of my career, trying to get across that as journalists, and particularly newsreaders, which has taken up the last few years of my working life, that, you know, there are three dimensions to us. It's not just the voice sort of sitting there reading out loud. And I've been keen recently to try to show that there are other things that I can do, and the BBC's been willing to give me opportunities in that regard. And I've you know, had a passion for classical music and for opera and for jazz as well, music in general, frankly, you know, since I was a teenager and heading into university. And it's a part of life that is important to the richness of all our lives, I think, for majority of people: music, art, literature, and so on. Sport. And I think we've all realized that to an acute level during lockdown and during COVID, that it's some of the simpler pleasures in life that are perhaps the most important. And I've been keen to try to show that. And if an opportunity has popped up for me to get involved, then you know, that's great. And I'm happy to do that. Absolutely.
You've mentioned there that there are lots of different parts to you, to Clive Myrie, lots of different strings to the bow. You're notoriously private as a person, though, and yet how are you adjusting to this other part of you, which is kind of hosting Mastermind?
Yeah, yeah.
How are you adjusting to the increased profile around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, look, you know, I thought I was doing okay, you know, in my career, you know, a bit of foreign reporting, bit of that, the odd bauble on the mantelpiece, came back, did a bit of presenting, bit of this, bit of that. And then I get Mastermind. And I might as well have just been an earthworm, you know, for the previous 25 years. And I have to say, it was a shock. It was a huge shock. It takes the public profile to a completely different level, which has been very, very strange and overwhelming, actually. At times, for someone, as you say, who is, you know, pretty private and for whom the public has only seen pretty much two dimensions. So it has been an adjustment. But most people are kind. Most people, you know, want to wish you well and want you to succeed. And, you know, people will stop you in the street and that kind of thing, which is gratifying that they're stopping you in the street and they're not wanting to bash you over the head. You know, most people are decent in that way. And that's, I suppose, there's nothing you can do about it, really. I mean, you know, I'm not sure how you present a programme, you know, how you present the 10 o'clock news, present Mastermind, and then hide away. I'm not sure if that is possible. And if it is possible, does it really make sense? So maybe you just try to go with it and try to deal with it. you know, as best you can. And I think that's what I've been trying to do. But also using it actually as a platform to get out all that other stuff about the importance of journalism, the importance of impartiality, due impartiality, you know, not just he said, she said, the importance of a free media, the importance of being careful when you're reading stuff online and social media and so on. You know, using it as a platform to mention all those other things that are important to me. So from that point of view, it's been good too.
On the point about using it as a platform, we tend to ask all of our guests why journalism matters to them. And you've answered that question a little bit there. But from your perspective, why does journalism matter?
Originally, I just wanted to travel. I just wanted to go to sort of weird places and see, you know, interesting different things. I mean, I grew up with a guy called Alan Wicker, and he had a program called Wicker's World. And I was just transported to Kyoto when, you know, he's talking to geishas and, you know, baby doc in Haiti and, you know, people in California having facelifts. This is in the sort of 70s, 80s. And I was just fascinated by all this. And as a result, for me, journalism was a way to travel the world and see different things and enjoy different things. And then I understood also that it was an important way of informing people about the world in which they live, and allowing people the opportunity, in a small way, if they have the right information, to make the right kind of choices about their lives, about who they should vote for, about where they should live, about society in general. And I very much hold that idea deeply in my heart now, that particularly in the fractured media landscape in which we live, where there is multiplicity of sources for news, a lot of them rubbish, a lot of them nonsense, a lot of them you shouldn't believe. And as a result, I do feel it's important that we try to be, you know, truth tellers as much as we can, you know. And obviously there are personal prejudices and beliefs and biases and all that stuff. But there can be some objective truths. And I think as journalists, it's really important for us to try to sort of hold true to those objective truths now, because I've lived and worked in societies where, you know, it's difficult for that to happen, whether it's the United States or, frankly, covering this war. I mean, you know, a simple fact is that Vladimir Putin says that this is a special operation, and we're doing it to liberate the people of Ukraine, and they're welcoming us as liberators, and it's all great. Why is there no free media in Russia then? Every single bit of propaganda that comes out of the Kremlin can be knocked down by the simple fact that there is no free media in Russia. It's as obvious as night follows day that the guy's up to something dodgy, and yet there is a whole world out there of people who will still apologise and make excuses. That's why we do what we do. And that's why he wants to shut it down.
We ask all our podcast guests one specific moment in their reporting career that may have impacted them, may have changed the course of their work, perhaps something that they come back to and reflect on continually, and maybe how that helps them understand their mental health. Do you have a moment?
Yeah, So I've been thinking about this, and what I realise as I've got older is that I viscerally feel the pain of others much more keenly than I used to. And I'm not entirely sure why that has happened, but I've become much more attuned to the suffering of others. And it's much more difficult for me to divorce that suffering and compartmentalize it when I leave a particular story. And I realize that part of the reason, and I don't know if that's made me a worse reporter or a better reporter or hasn't affected me at all, but it is something that I understand now has happened. And I feel, as I say, very, very acutely someone else's pain. And I realised that this may stem from my reporting in East Timor, which would have been 98, 99, yeah, something like that, late 90s. And Indonesia's attempt to keep this little island under its thumb. And there was a woman that I came across who was heavily pregnant. I mean, literally, probably about to give birth there and then. And she was disorientated, completely traumatized. Her village had been burnt down. She'd lost her husband. She'd lost her two children. She'd lost her parents. She was completely on her own. And she was just in tears and just wandering around, and we managed to get her some help. But I realized that I, at that moment, I put myself in her situation. And I sort of told myself, well, how would I cope if I'd lost everything? My home, my family, my friends, everything. How would I deal with it? And I suppose that's how I've tried to report ever since. You do that instinctively, or you at least you hope you're doing that instinctively anyway, putting the viewer in the shoes of the person involved in the story, trying to imprint their narrative on the viewer and listener so that they get a visceral sense of what's going on. But I think I realized I pushed towards that kind of storytelling much more after that situation. And I was much more willing to fall back on due impartiality and not just impartiality. Clearly, there is someone here who is not being very nice, and there is someone here who is suffering. And I think I've decided that I'm much more willing to say this person is not being very nice, rather than say, well, there may be a reason this person is not being very nice, and we should look at why this person is not being very nice. And as a result of that, perhaps that lessens the pain of the person who is being hurt. I'm a big fan of due impartiality. And I think a lot of that is born out of that experience in East Timor. And just for some reason, with that woman, putting myself literally in her shoes.
There's so much empathy in what you described there. And there's, you know, I'm not sure that anybody could fail to be moved by that description you made just then of the woman in East Timor. So thank you so much for sharing that. It's been such a privilege hearing you speak about your experiences. I'd like to just ask you for one, I guess, final piece of advice, really. We know that talking about mental health can be incredibly difficult for many, but also hearing others talk can be really helpful. People feel less isolated. What would be one thing you've learned about managing your mental health that you feel would be beneficial for colleagues to hear?
I think it's about being honest with yourself and truthful with yourself that perhaps you've reached a certain limit, that perhaps you can't go on anymore, that perhaps now is the time to stop, reassess, refocus so that things don't get worse. And it's not about battling through that and being able to tell yourself you're a hero because you're doing that, or tell your employer you're a hero because you're doing that. Actually being heroic is being around for your family and your friends and the people that love you. That's the most profound truth, I think. And if you're honest with yourself about that, then you'll be happier.
Clive Myrie, and what an amazing piece of advice he finished with there, knowing when to stop. Because how often do we actually give ourselves permission to stop at that point?
That's something that I will definitely take with me. I must confess, it's sometimes a piece of self-care that I don't always follow. So we hope that you've really enjoyed Clive's words there. If you want to share it, whatever channel you listen to this podcast on, please do. Thanks very much for listening to Behind the Headlines.